This morning we talked about the Greek text. We talked about the superiority of our King James Bible in different aspects. I forgot to hold up this book. I talked about it, and I said, why don't you hold that book up defending the King James Bible? And this series of meetings is going to take up all four of these superiorities: superior texts, superior translators, superior technique of translation, and superior theology. Right now we're in superior texts. This morning we took a little bit of time to talk about the superior Hebrew Old Testament text. We got into a little bit of the superior Greek text. We want to continue that Greek text superiority this afternoon, and so we're going to take a look at that. That's more important than the Old Testament because it's in the New Testament that the things are developed. Is that Brother Nick there? Pastor Nick, he's one of our pastors. Where we're just young people, he's really not young people. And Brother Nick, would you stand up and lead us in a word of prayer before the Lord? He's an old time pastor. Lead us in a word of prayer. He doesn't think so. That's all right. Thank you, Brother Nick. All right. You're in your 90s, are you, Brother Nick? Are you in your 90s? How old are you? How old are you today?
91.
91, okay. All right, so he didn't hear, but we'll get to him one of these days. Thank you very much.
We've
known him almost 91 years. Not exactly. So, we're talking about the superior Greek text. And the superior Greek text is a very important part because that's where the doctrines are of the New Testament. That's where the things that we should know about, and this is very important indeed. We talked this morning about Weston Hort. Bishop Weston and Professor Hort were professors and members of the Greek Department of Cambridge University. They're from the Anglican Church, the Church of England. And the Church of England is very much decided against the text Preceptus and in favor of the false text, indeed. And so we talked about some of the definitions of Weston and some of the beliefs of him. Now let's take a look at Professor Hort. Professor Hort was with his friend, and he wrote to J.B. Lightfoot. They were going to make a commentary together, and Hort, who said this, if you make a decided conviction of the absolute infallibility of the New Testament, practically a sine qua non, which is Latin for without which not, in other words, an absolute indispensable thing, for cooperation, I fear I could not join you. That was Life and Letters of Hort, Volume 1, page 420. And he could not be convinced that there was an infallible scripture. And, of course, as I said before, those fundamental Bible-believing men who are Christians, many of them do not agree with us, and they say that Weston Hort, both of them were with the Lord, and both of them were conservatives. How can a conservative deny the infallibility of the New Testament? That's the question indeed. Then also, writing to Brenton, Hort says here, this was in 1886, referring to the Article 9 of the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church. Now, the Church of England has 39 articles. That's their doctrinal statement. And he referred to Article 9 of those articles. Now, you'd think a minister ordained to the Church of England would accept their doctrinal position. He says, the authors of this article doubtless assume the strict historical character of the account of the fall in Genesis. That is the fall of man. This assumption is now, in my belief, no longer reasonable. But the early chapters of Genesis remain a divinely appointed parable or apologue setting forth important practical truths and subjects which, as matter of history, are outside our present ken or understanding. So here these men that think that Genesis and the chapters of Genesis and the fall of man are simply parables. They don't really mean that they actually fell. But if man did not fall, then the Lord Jesus Christ did not have to come into existence. No reason for the redemption of the precious blood of Christ. And certainly, when he says they're no longer reasonable, since when does God have to conform with our reason? Now, sometimes things are reasonable. But television isn't reasonable to me. Radio isn't reasonable to me. Going to the moon is not reasonable to me. Airwaves are long for television things. All a lot of things. Electricity is not even reasonable to me. This PowerPoint that's going to project this out of this is not reasonable, but it's a fact. And I know it. I can see it. But the law of gravity is not reasonable, but it happens. You don't believe it, just look at the plane crashes. But reasonability is not the test of truth. God is above our reason, above our ken, above our knowledge. He's omniscient. He knows all, and we not should question. And so this court questioning historical character, the fall is not there, then Christ does not need to come to take us away from our sins. Again, here's a court denying a literal Garden of Eden. I'm inclined to think that no such state as Eden, I mean the popular notion, ever existed. And that Adam's fall in no degree differs from the fall of each of his descendants, as Coleridge justly argued. This is Life and Letters of Hort, Volume 1, page 78. As we said this morning, their sons have compiled all of the father's letters. Life and Letters of Westcott, Life and Letters of Hort. 900 pages or so in each of these two volumes of six. And here, the son quoting his father in a letter to Ellington, 1848, no such state as Eden. But the Garden of Eden never existed, and the serpent never existed, and the temptation never existed, the fall never existed, therefore the Bible is not true. And this is a serious rejection of truth. And Hort cannot be considered, as Boston University considers him to be, a conservative. If that's their definition of conservative, we better question what they're talking about. And other fundamental Bible-believing Christians of other schools are saying also these men are Christian conservatives. Here's a letter that Professor Hort wrote to Westcott in 1860. Have you read Darwin? How I should like to talk with you about it. It's rather difficult. I'm inclined to think it is unanswerable. In any case, it's a treat to read such a book. Arthur Hort, Life and Letters, Volume 1, page 414. You know and I know that Darwin was the founder of evolution, of man, from either monkeys or tadpoles or some other particular creature. And to say that you read Darwin is quite a bit unanswerable. If he's rejected the chapters of Genesis that talk about God's creation, no wonder. This is, as Dr. Schaefer has mentioned to us in his classes in Dallas Seminary years ago when he was teaching us, the theory of evolution is the only thing man has left completely unaided by revelation. It's always got left. If he doesn't have revelation, he doesn't have the Word of God, doesn't have creation, evolution is the best thing he can do. And it's a terrible thing. It's so contradictory. But again, can you imagine a conservative saying that Darwin is all right and unanswerable? To me, that's not conservatism. That's liberalism. That's apostasy of modernism. And our brethren who think these fellows are all right and conservatives ought to read some of those things they've written. Now, I realize that Life and Letters of Hort is 900 pages. I'm going to wade through that whole thing. A lot of letters they wrote were fine. But it's what they say that is unfine that tips off what their theology is. Life and Letters of Westcott, 900 pages we have in their Bible for their ministry. It's available in copy machine form. People can read it. Guess where we got the original copy? From Bob Jones University Library. They know it. They've got it. If they read it, they believe it, and they can understand plain English, they themselves will have to agree with us. These men were not conservatives, but far from it. And then here's what Hort and Westcott said in their introduction to the Greek New Testament. We learn next that B, that is the Vatican manuscript, very far exceeds all other documents in neutrality of text, as measured by the above text. Test, being in fact always or nearly always neutral. It's important to see that these two unbelievers, Bishop Westcott, Professor Hort, accepted document B. Now, we asked the question earlier somewhat, what is a manuscript? Well, that comes from two Greek words, or Latin words actually, manus, which is hand, and scriptus, to write. And manuscript, handwritten documents. And this manuscript B, which is the Vatican, 400 AD, they say that is it. You know, Shakespeare had a play, I believe it was a play or a book, to be or not to be, remember that? That is the question. These fellows have B, the manuscript B, the Vatican manuscript, was in the Vatican Library. It was there, never used. The church never used it. It's in perfect condition. Talk about a perfect book that's in excellent condition. If you don't use something, it does stay in excellent condition, I'm sure. If you use it, you thumb it to death, and it's gone. But because of its disuse, it was kept perfect. And because the churches have rejected it, they didn't want to use it. It was never copied and recopied. It just sat there. And so these men were enthralled with manuscript B, the Vatican manuscript, 4th century, just because it's oldest, it's the oldest, it has to be the best, not necessarily, so we're not contaminated with heretics, which it was, then it would be probably the best, but This is what they're after. Now, notice the deviant origin of Westcott and Horst B. or the Vatican manuscript. This is a quotation from Bruce Metzger, who was a very great Greek scholar in Princeton Seminary, Princeton University, New Jersey. And we don't agree with his Greek beliefs, but he wrote this. He's a supporter of the Alexandrian text. He's compelled to catalog the vast amount of religious corruption which came from Alexandria. Now, B and Aleph originated in Alexandria, Egypt. But Alexandria, Egypt was also the source of the Gnostic heresy. The Gnostics were centered in Alexandria. And these manuscripts came from Alexandria. So our friend Metzger, who's not really our friend theologically, but our man Metzger, says among the Christians, as he says, which during the second century either originated in Egypt or circulated there among both the Orthodox and the Gnostics, are numerous apocryphal gospels, that's false gospels, Acts and epistles and apocalypses. Some of the more noteworthy are the gospel according to the Egyptians, the gospel of truth, the gospel of Thomas, the gospel of Philip, the kerygma. All these are false gospels. The kerygma of Peter, the Acts of John, the epistle of Barnabas, epistle of the apostles, and the apocalypse of Peter. There are also fragments of exegetical and dogmatic works composed by Alexandrian Christians, chiefly Gnostics, during the second century. Let's pause right here. Gnostics, what did they believe? It's easy to say what they did not believe. Gnostics come from gnosis, which just means knowledge, and what they think they know everything, and full knowledge, complete and all everything, can't tell them anything. They deny the deity of Christ. They deny the virgin birth, the bodily resurrection, salvation by grace through faith. This is the Gnostic heresy. And these manuscripts came from the Gnostic part of Alexandria, Egypt, and they're completely in conformity with the Gnostic doctrines. And so, it's no mystery that there are 356 doctrinal passages where these B and Vatican manuscripts are in contradiction to truth. 356 of them. Because the Gnostics changed it. And he's saying all these are Gnostic during the second century. We know, for example, such Jesus Basilides, he was a Gnostic heretic. His son Isidore, and the Valentinians, another heretic, and Ptolemaeus, Heraclian, Pantenes, all but the last mentioned, were unorthodox in one respect or another. Here's the seedbed of heresy, Alexandria, Egypt. This was the origin of B and Al, Vatican science. Yet these are the manuscripts on which the new versions are based. They're based on B and Al, Vatican science, the Gnostic heretical manuscripts that have been changed and altered. I'm talking about the New International Version, New American Standard Version, Revised Standard, New Revised Standard, English Standard, the Message. All these modern versions are based on this false foundation, which is wrong. All these men unorthodox except one, in one respect or another. Then Dr. Metzger says this: the judge with the comments made by Clement of Alexandria, who was one of the heretics, by the way, a Gnostic heretic. Almost every deviant Christian sect was represented in Egypt during the second century. Clement mentions the Valentinians, Basilidians, Marcionites, Horatii, Cretathites, Docetus, Hamathites, Canaanites, Ophites, Simonians, and Eutychus. Now notice what Dr. Metzger says. What proportion of Christians in Egypt during the second century were Orthodox is not known. Now this is Bruce Metzger's early versions, page 101, quoted by Dr. Mormon in his manuscript, page 40. If indeed these manuscripts, B and Al, the Vatican and Sinai manuscripts, come out of this background, I call it a garbage dump of theology. A garbage dump of theology. Even Metzger himself, who's a modernist apostate in Princeton Seminary, who doesn't even think that he's the one that's the author of the what's called the Reader's Digest Bible, where they throw out most of the Bible, he's the editor of it. He doesn't believe Peter wrote Peter, Paul didn't write any epistles of Paul, so on and so forth. Metzger himself says he doesn't even know in the second century, which is the origin of these bad manuscripts, doesn't know how many people in Alexandria were Orthodox. The climate of Orthodox. Can you bring a good thing out of the bad? Well, Jesus asked that question. And can you bring truth out of error? Afraid with that. You question it. Well, you don't go to the garbage pail for good food. As I say, there may be some, but not much. So this is the deviant origin. Now, Here's the quotation from Herman Haske, Codex Bienensalis. It's over 900 pages. We've reproduced this. It's available. And Herman Haske stood for the text of the Septuagint that underlies our King James Bible. Here's what he said about Westcott and Hort, the text. He said, "Those who accept W.H., Westcott and Hort, are basing their accusations of untruth as to the Gospelists, that is, the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, upon an Egyptian revision. First of all, we must realize B and Aleph are revisions." Well, if it's a revision, there had to be an original. The original was the Greek text that underlies the King James Bible. That's the traditional text. Text receptus, received text, call it what you will. And these texts, B and Aleph, that the Westcott and Hort people worshipped, were revisions from Egypt, Alexander Egypt. That's the first one. Second thing, current, 200 to 450 AD. He admits they were current. They didn't have fast means of communication. They didn't know anybody from Egypt to sing up to those in Palestine or Jerusalem or Rome or anywhere in the northern part that these were corrupt. It was current because that's all they knew. Current and flourishing from 200 to 450. Notice the next part. And abandoned between 500 to 1881. That's the next part. Abandoned during that period of 1381 years. Abandoned. Now the thing about it is you've got to ask yourself, and people that worship these manuscripts should ask themselves, why were these abandoned? Were these churches nitwits? Were these Christians fools? Were these Christians blinded? Didn't they know the truth when they saw it? Why was it abandoned? Why didn't they copy it? Why didn't they recopy it? That's a question to ask those who worship still at the shrine of being out, at the shrine that Westcott and Hort worshiped. Abandoned between 500 to 1881. Now notice, merely revived in our day. Haske was writing in the 1800s, late 1800s. Merely revived in our day. Now that's what Westcott and Hort did. They revived the things that the Christians had buried. They resurrected the things that were buried and decaying in the tombs and brought them up from the dead. That's what they did. Revived. But notice the last part. And stamped as genuine. Now, because someone stamped something genuine, does that make it genuine? See, Westcott and Hort, Mr. Westcott, Professor Hort, stamped that thing. That's genuine. I can stamp a piece of paper for $1 million. Does that make it genuine? Absolutely not. They arrest me for counterfeiting. And so the stamp does not make it so. But this is the history. And then Haske goes on. The plain fact is that Aleph and B and C and L, Delta C, really represent but one document, and that one at variance with all others. But as explained above, it's anything but a neutral document. Now, this Codex Bienensalis, an interesting document. Herman Haske compares B and Aleph. It's a very technical book, 900 pages. Most of them in Greek, the comparison of charts and graphs and this verse and this verse. The sum and substance of it is, in B and Aleph alone, in the Gospels alone, B and Aleph, in the Gospel alone, when he compares it to, there are over 3,000 real differences between these two documents, B and Aleph. Well, if there are 3,000 serious differences between these two documents in the four Gospels alone, why should we trust either of them? See? But maybe I'm getting ahead of my story. Let me see. The text, here's a modern Greek text. Now, I guess I'm not getting ahead of story. I didn't mention, but on some of these, I do mention some of these details, but the 3,000 differences show that the B and Aleph are different even among themselves in the Gospels. Now, the question that is posed by some, Dean Bergan, I think, mentioned this question. He said, suppose you were a judge, and suppose you had two witnesses come before you, and suppose they contradicted one another. One says it's A, one says it's B. They contradict another time. One said the thing is purple, the other says blue. And so on. 3,000 times contradicting one another. If you were a judge, what would you do to those two witnesses? What would you do?
Throw both out.
Throw both out. That's what I would do. That's what they should do. That's what they should be all both thrown out. But anyway. Now, you say, well, why are we getting involved with the heresies of Westcott and Hort? That's that little booklet here, the heresies of Westcott and Hort. Remember all the doctrines. Why do we say much about that? Because there in 1881, This is 2006. The reason I say that is that their work on the Greek text, their hatchet job on the traditional text that they revised there with me and now with the Vatican, Sinai, and Egypt, that text is almost identical with the text that they worship today. And so it's good to see the history of the modern versions, the critical text. Some texts call it Westendorf text. Some people call it the Nestle-Aland text, Nestle's and Aland. Some people call it the Matabiosali text. But whatever you call it, all these different ones worship the two documents, Vini and Aland. And I learned in geometry when I was in high school, things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Is that right? So if all four of these different things worship Vini and Aland, won't you assume that they're just pretty much identical? There's a few changes here and there, but the reason I'm saying about Western Hort is if you don't know the origin of the false Greek text that people today worship and the versions that are based on these false texts, if you don't know the origin, that they were unbelievers, that they weren't Christian, Bible conservatives and fundamentalists, then you don't understand. Now, some of these men, friends of ours that are on the other side of this issue, like Bob Jones and other places, they say, well, Westendorf text had nothing whatever to do with the text today. Why do you bring up Westendorf? Don't you know that they had nothing to do with it? This is a different text. That's 1881. We're now living in 2006. Let me give you at least five or six quotations showing that Westendorf did have an influence on present-day texts. Quotation number one. This is from Henry Hasker, 1914. The text printed by Westendorf has been accepted as the true text, and grammars, works on the synoptic problem, works on higher criticism, and others have been grounded on this text. That's 1914. This is a quotation from Jay Greenlee, an apostate liberal, 1964, from the New Testament textual criticism. Quotation number three. This is 1979, D.A. Carson, King James Version of it. Another, D.A. Carson is a new evangelical, he's at least a Christian, but he doesn't agree with us. What does he say? The theories of Westendorf are almost universally accepted today. Subsequent textual critical work since 1881 accepted the theories of Westendorf. The vast majority of evangelical scholars hold that the basic textual theories of Westendorf were right, and the church stands bravely in their debt. I don't agree with that at all. The church should abandon the theories of Westendorf and abandon their texts. We should not be indebted to apostates, the ones that want to twist the truth, as we saw earlier this morning. Another quotation. This is 1980. This is Wilbur Pickering, Identity of the New Testament Text. Graduate of Dallas Seminary, as I. He's a conservative. He's a new evangelical, but he's a Bible-believing Christian. What did he say? The two most popular manual editions of the Greek text today, Nestle-Aland and the United Bible Society, really vary little from the Westendorf text. Now that's another quote. They vary very little from that. And then John Kohlenberger, now he's an advocate of the New International Version. What does he say? 1987. Westendorf, all subsequent versions, from the revised version, 1881, to those of the present, have adopted their basic approach and accepted the Westendorf Greek text. If that isn't enough, let's go to one more. Maybe two more. All right, here's Philip Comfort. Again, a liberal in this case, but 1990. He says, but textual critics have not been able to advance beyond Hort in formalizing a theory. This has troubled certain textual scholars. It's troubled me. More than a textual scholar, it certainly troubled me. I guess we'll take one more. This is from my friend, Dr. Kirk DeVico, a Baptist pastor in New Jersey at that time. He's not in Massachusetts. He's one of our executive committee members of our Dean Burbank Society. And he wrote to Dr. Bruce Lester, their principal. And he and other members of the Nestle-Aland United Bible Society committees, he was on the committee. He wondered how they began their work on the New Testament text. And he got a letter replied by Dr. Messer in his own handwriting, which we produced in our Dean Burgon Society minutes and in our records of it and our messages. And here's what he said. Remember, the question was, Dr. Messer, you're on the committee of the United Bible Society and the Nestle-Aland text on both committees. a number of these men that are against me or anyone else getting after West Baton Rouge for anything are saying West Baton Rouge had nothing to do with present-day Greek text. But we've had these other statements from these other men from 1914 to the 1990. Let's see what Dr. Metzger said, what he did to begin his work with the Nestle-Aland text and the United Bible Society text. Here's what he said. Quote, we took as our base at the beginning the text of West Baton Rouge, 1881, and introduced changes as seemed necessary at the basis of manuscript evidence. This is found in his own handwriting, page 272 of the Edinburgh Society Messages from the 16th annual meeting, August 1994. That's the silence of our conference. Here's the man who's one of the many men, they have five or six men on that committee, the Nestle-Aland text and the United Bible Society text. We have a Roman Catholic cardinal, he's on that. We've got several Protestants, all of them apostates. Bruce Metzger's on that, and he asked him, how did you do the starters? So when men and brethren say to us, don't mix up people with West God and Hort, they're dead and buried, that's the end of it. Their text has nothing to do with the Greek text we use at Bob Jones University, the Frank Baptist Seminary, Central Seminary, Calvary Seminary, all the other seminaries, Dallas Seminary, my school. Don't mix up West Baton Rouge. It had nothing to do with it. I forgot to mention this morning, someone asked me at the break about some things, and I said, well, I didn't know there was any other text but West Baton Rouge when I went to school at Dallas Seminary. 1948 to 1952, and then graduate work at 53. The text they gave us to study Greek with was Westcott and Fort. So don't tell me that Westcott and Fort doesn't have an influence on present-day people. So that's what I studied Greek on, Westcott and Fort. The very thing with this stuff, gave it to us in the bookstore, see. And for 20 years, I didn't know any other text. 20 long years, trained at Dallas. Wasn't training, it was indoctrination at Dallas. 20 long years before I even knew there was such a thing as a traditional text, a text receptive. And I learned it from one of my students. I was a professor and teacher at Shelton College, at Conaconcourt School in Cape May, New Jersey, and one day in a Greek class, I guess it was, I don't know what class, Greek to speak, Sandra Phillips raised her hand and said, Sandy, do you have a question? Yes, Dr. Lee, did you know there was a book in our library, Shelton College, that stands for the King James Bible? And the Greek text that underlies it? I said, no, Sandy, I didn't realize that. She was referring to Dean Burgon's book, The Revision Revised. So from that point, I began to look into that. I found not only Dean Burgon's book, that's why we printed it. That's why we started the Dean Burgon Society. I awoke after 20 years of sleep and changed. And I'm absolutely convinced that the truth is all on the side of the text receptus that underlies the King James Bible. And it's against VNL. It's against this false base of Westcott and Fort. We've been writing and speaking and talking ever since. That was 1950-something, I guess it was. And now it's 2000, 50 years almost that we've been talking about. Yes, that was 1971, she told me today. But Westcott had a lot to do with people today. This is why the fundamentalist brethren must glorify West Baton Rouge. They have to say they're conservatives. They must say they're fundamental. They must say they're Bible believers. They must say they're with the Lord. Because if they won't say, as I say, as some of the quotations clearly say, if they ever say they're apostates and heretics, that would cause confusion because, oh, you're taking the Greek text of apostates as your text? You believe that that's what you should teach your people about? People that originated being modernists and leprosy, it would not wash. And so they must defend the orthodoxy of Eden. Now, the manuscript evidence supporting the last 12 verses of Mark, we're going to take this as an example, an illustration. It's an important illustration because Mark 16, 9-20 is questioned in the NIV, in the New American Standard Version, the Revised Standard Version, because B and Aleph eliminate the last 12 verses of Mark. Dean Burgon has written an entire book, 350 pages plus, on the last 12 verses of Mark. He reprinted it and he published it in our Dean Burgon Society. Well, let's take a look at some of the evidences. Now, there are three different things that determine what the right manuscript is or what the right words are. Number one, you have manuscripts, whatever they may be. Secondly, you have early versions, early translations. Thirdly, you have early church fathers that wrote about things and they're dated, what did they have in their hands when they wrote? So these different things. Let's take a look at Mark 16:9-20 and see the manuscript evidence, the version or translation of it, and then the early church fathers' quotations, what they held in their hands. First of all, the manuscript evidence. In Dean Bergman's day, B and Aleph are the only two manuscripts that omitted Mark 16:9-20. There are a few, maybe tiny ones today we have, but in his day, just the two. How about those that were for it? How many of those that have 18 uncials? Those are capital letter manuscripts. About 600 cursive copies, those flowing hand manuscripts. In other words, every known uncial or cursive in existence, plus every known lectionary of the East, the lectionaries, the things read in the churches. They had portions of the New Testament that they read at certain feast days. And Mark 16:9-20 was one of those feast days in the time of the resurrection. They read it. It's in their churches. There wasn't a single church in that time that took it away. That's the evidence for it. Now notice, B and Aleph, 2 against 18, 600, 618. Every known lectionary, probably 300 more. Who are you going to believe as to the authenticity of Mark 16:9-20, as far as its origin, as far as its usefulness? Let's go beyond that. Let's go ahead and take the early versions or translations. Notice the dates over here, 100 to 199. These first six dates up to 350 AD either predate or precede B and Aleph, which are 4th century, 375 or so AD. And notice, every one of those first six contains Mark 16:9-20. Peshitta Syriac, Bethesda, the Old Latin, the Puritonian Syriac, the Sahidic Egyptian, the Semitic Coptic Egyptian, Gothic of Ophelus, and these others as well, that post-date, Latin Vulgate, Puritonian Syriac, Ethiopic, and Georgian. Now, my question is, how in the world could these six, in fact, all 10 of these early versions of translations, how could they have Mark 16:9-20 in the same order, same verses, same words, exactly the same, if they never existed until, well, they never existed, how could they have no origin? How could they be exact? They had to have existed in Mark's original gospel for these early translations. Where did they translate it from? They had to have an authority from that. And they must have had Mark's original gospel from which they could translate all of these other language translations to get these verses in. That certainly is evidence. And finally, the 19 church fathers that support Mark 16:9-20. Manuscript evidence, early versions, now the church fathers. The church fathers were men that wrote extensively in the early churches, church age. We don't have to agree with their theology. Many of them are apostates, in fact. But they would fight one with another, these early church fathers, about doctrine. They'd quote this verse and quote that verse and so on and so on. The only thing we're talking about church fathers, and not because we agree with all of them, because they're heretical, many of them, but what version of the Bible did they have in their hand when they quoted it? That's the issue. See? What did they have? Did they have the Westbound North B and Aleph text? Did they have the text Receptus that originated from Paul, the apostles, and all the others? Well, Papias, 180, he quotes from Mark 16:18, part of the last 12 verses of Mark. Where did he get it? He had it in his hand. He lived in 180. That's way before B and Aleph came into existence in 400 or 375 AD. 151, Justin Martyr quoted from Mark 16:20. 180, Irenaeus quoted. Hippolytus, 200. Vincentius, 256. From Lyons and Corpus in near Rome in Africa, they all had in their hands the real gospel and they quoted from it. And even though we don't agree necessarily with their doctrines, we agree with what the Bible that they had in their hands. Here's another one. Acta Palatae, which is a group of instructions from early church, they quote from 250 AD. Apostolic Constitutions quoted from Mark 16:9-20. Eusebius, Marinus, Epaphras the Persian, and all these others from 11 down to 19. But the first 10 predated and precursors of B and L. So we have all of these evidences as to one section. Now, Dean Bergon has a number of issues. He says that cruxism interpretation, something to that effect. Cruxism interpretation, very serious. one of the main cruxes of interpretation is which text you take is this Mark 16:9-20. Read the whole book on it. And convinced ones who read it, convinced me certainly, that this is proper, that the text of the Septuagint, the underlies of King James, of all those verses from Mark are genuine. Another one is Luke 2:14, and there's certain interpretive, very important parts, and this is one of them, so I illustrated it. Now, if indeed 19 church fathers quote from Mark 16:9-12, if indeed 10 early versions, translations, quoted and translated Mark 16:9-12, if it's indeed true that 18 uncial capital letter manuscripts have Mark 16:9-20, over 600 cursive copies have Mark 16:9-20, and every single lectionary of the East that had their Bibles that they quoted from Scripture all had Mark 16:9-20, and the only ones that don't have it are B and Aleph, what does that say about B and Aleph, Vatican, Sinai manuscripts? What does that tell you? To me, it speaks volumes. And it's like the illustration of when I was at Navy Chapel with the Marines for 2 years, for 5 years at Navy Chapel, we went to the graduation sometimes at Virginia, Quantico, or at least the Chaplain School of Newport, Rhode Island, and various other things. But, you know, and every time they have a change of command, they have a big group of men, Marines, whatever, Navy men, marching in front of the general, whoever he is, changing command, whatever the admiral, whoever it might be. And as they march by, they salute this leader, this new captain, whoever he is, commander. And the illustration is the lady that saw her son, I don't know what his name was, let's call him Andy. As he was going through the parade and through this review stand of the commander that was taking over the new leader of that particular post, she noticed something. The mother said, everyone, there must have been 1,000 troops parading in front of this stand. And the mother said, everyone is out of step for my Andy. Everyone's out of step for my Andy. Now, I know mothers love sons. We have 4 of them, and a daughter. But this is the story we have with B and I, Vatican Sinai. All of them out of step. All the 19 church fathers, all the 10 early versions, all the 600 curses and 18 uncials, and all the lectionary, out of step. But my B, my habit, to be or not to be, that is a question. That's what they say. They worship me. And I don't, as you can tell. Group by dates, 2nd century, 3 early church fathers. 3rd century, 4 of them. 4th century, 6 church fathers. 5th century, 4 more. 2 in the 6th century. 5 centuries, 19 church fathers. They all had quotations from Mark 16:9-20. It's amazing, indeed. Now, here's the battleground. The battleground between the text of the Septuagint, the received text, that's all that word means, a Latin term, is this. The TR, as we call it, has 140,521 words. You know, plus or minus, you may have differences. It has about 647 pages, in at least the volume that I have. It's about 317 words per page. Now, that's the text that underlies a King James Bible. That text is down the book table. It's by Dr. Scrivener. Scrivener's annotated Greek New Testament, so it's called. And that's the exact Greek text that underlies the King James Bible, the very words underlying that Bible. Dr. Scrivener was commissioned by the University of Cambridge in 1881 after the English Revised Version and the Greek text of Westcott Hort came out. He was commissioned. Dr. Scrivener was a great Greek scholar, friend of Dean Bergen, in fact, and a conservative. And he was on that 1881 English Revised Version Committee. He argued with Hort and Westcott continuously, debating back and forth, don't change this, but they changed it because they had a majority vote. But Scribner was all alone many times in that battle. And Scribner was commissioned by the University of Cambridge, give us a Greek text that exactly has the words underlying our King James Bible. And that's what it is. And then he was told to change, or not change any of the words, but whenever a word was different in the Westcott and Hort text, put it in bold letters, and put a footnote how they changed it. That's exactly what they did. Now, our son, D.A. Wade Jr., has spent hundreds of hours taking an English for the English reading. Now, that's also a book that's on the back book table. He's called it the Doctor New Testament. The Doctor New Testament. Because it was Dr. Westcott and Dr. Ford. He's taken the Greek Scrivener's annotated Greek New Testament in English, the King James Bible, and every time they changed the word, he put that in bold letters and the footnotes how they changed it. So that any English-speaking person can take a look at that Doctor New Testament. They can see where every one of these new verses come out or how they've changed this and changed that and added that and added these other. So the important thing, the Bible, between the textual surface. Now, what's kind of more changes in texture? They changed it in 5,604 places. You say, how do you get that? Well, I took that description of Greek New Testament, the bold letters. I was in a Bible conference one summer. My wife wasn't with me, so I had a little extra time. You know, husbands, what that means. A little extra time, my wife isn't there. You miss your wife, but you have a little extra time. You don't have to go shopping and different other things. That's why I have to do it. I'm not against shopping. You don't have to spend too much money. I was there and I counted every one of these black words and passages in Scripture that I came up with 5,604. Want to count them? Go ahead and count them. Just a few, that's fine. I won't be mad at you. And then that includes 9,970 words. Change the West County. How do I know that? Well, again, I counted all the words in the footnotes. 1, 2, 3, just added up to 9,970. That they've changed, either added words, subtracted words, or changed words in some other way. Now that's 15 words per page. That's 7% of the words of the entire New Testament. If you put all the changes page against page, it's 45.9 pages of the Greek New Testament that Westcott and Hort have tampered with. They've either added words, or subtracted words, or changed words. That's why my edition, as I said, you can take that distributor's book out there and you count yourself, and maybe I've made a few mistakes, but that's the best I can come up with, and that's how I arrived at my statistics. Be honest about it. That's a great different change, isn't it? Now, a new research book of Dr. Jack Moore, I mentioned this morning, I just want to review it, is come on. He's on our Dean Bergen Executive Committee. He's our scholar, resident scholar in England. He's a pastor there, he's a Baptist pastor. I've been in his church, preached for him. And he has access to the British Library and all the other books. He's written a book called 8,000 Differences Between the Critical Text of Nestle Allen, 26, 27, and the Scrivener's Text of Septus. The Greek words are given with English translation from Matthew through Revelation. 8,000 differences. And that's how many there are. This is what it looks like. It's over 500 large pages. And if the men who ardently hold to the West Coast Hort Greek text, the critical Greek text, underlying the New Testament. If they are telling you that there's very, very little difference between your text and our text, please don't believe it. This is the document that shows very clearly 8,000 differences. We're working with a number of foreign countries trying to get their Bible as clear, as straight, and accurate as our Bible and King James Bible in their tongue. Dr. Humberto Gomez has come out with a Spanish Bible. And it's accurate, Old Testament, New Testament, conforming to the textual surface and the Masoretic text in Spanish. Because the 1860s no good, the 1865 is not as good, 1909, all these different Spanish, we're interested in Spanish versions as well as all versions of the world. They're doing the same in Korean. I told you this morning, in South Korea, has come up, Dr. Zhang, with the Korean Bible conforming it to the Tetrasepis, which is great. And they've done it with the Romanian Bible. And we're trying to get people to change to the Romanian Bible. Trinitarian Bible Society usually goes with the Tetrasepis. Had the false Ukrainian Bible, excuse me, Romanian Bible, for many years. Now they've finally taken it off and changed it. But they won't go with this right one. I wish they would. But there's a battle with the Chinese Bible. They've got a bad Bible, too. West Coast Hort, which is the old Chinese was all right, but when Westcott and Hort entered, they changed the whole thing. The CUV, the Chinese Union version, is a version that's just replete with Westcott and Hort falseness. And I told the brethren that are working on this, we have about 4, 5, or 6 Chinese brethren that are concerned about their Chinese Bible. And I said, the first book you've got to get is this book by Dr. Jack Moore, 8,000 Differences in the New Testament. You've got to check every one of those in your Chinese Bible and change it. Make it correct. Conform it to the text of the surface. That's the basic thing to have. It's very important. And they're trying to do that. They've got the book. There's a Chinese group over in Singapore that's working on that. There's some in North Jersey. There's some in Canada. And I'm sort of helping to coordinate as best I can with all these brethren. I'm for the heart language of the people to get the words of God. Not just English, but Spanish and French and German and Chinese and Romanian and all these other languages. But that's a good place to start. That Jack Mormon and Missing in Modern Bible is the full story being told. We counted up between the Nestle Island text and the text receptus, it's shorter by 2,886 Greek words. Shorter. Now, you feel like you've been gypped when you go to the store and you're supposed to get a pound of meat and you get a half a pound. Wouldn't you feel a little bit gypped at that? See? Or even 3/4 of a pound instead of a full pound. But if you're trying to get the whole counsel of God in the Greek text, 140,000 words, you got 2,886 of those words just completely eliminated from your New Testament. Shouldn't you be upset? Hey, that's the thing. And yet, shouldn't you wonder, which is right? Is it this one or that one or some other one? See? It should cause us pause to think and concern. And that's the fact. Dr. Jack Mormon is an exacting scholar, patient scholar. He went right straight down. Here's an Nestle-Aland Greek text. Here's a text receptus. Change here, change here, change right down from Matthew 1:1, 1:2, 1:3, 1:4. If you drop out 2,886 Greek words, stack them all up together, it'd be like dropping out the whole books of 1 Peter and 2 Peter in English. I mean, if you think of it, I used to, when I went through some of these things, I'd take a whole list of the same page after page and just fan it out. See how much has dropped out. 5 chapters in 1 Peter, 3 chapters in 2 Peter, 8 chapters in your Bible. If you put them all end on end, drop right out. It's a travesty on the words of God to drop out and change all that group. As we said earlier, Norman Hosker, Codex Binicolaeus, he compared B with Aleph and found a contradiction in other with one another in over 3,000 places in the Gospels alone, just the four Gospels. 3,000 places. One is right, the other is wrong. And that may both be wrong. They may both be wrong, but both of them cannot be right. If in 3,000 places in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John they're contradictory, it can't both be right. Now, what they've done, Westcott and Hort, they say, we want to go with B. Now, if Aleph or the Sinai manuscript differs with us, we're going to find out some other manuscript that agrees with B, and we'll go with that. That's what they're doing. The B all the way through. 3,000 places, contradictory. We talked about the judge, we talked about what you do with those, and this. Now, with this place here, and I'd like to mention there are 37 historical links supporting the text receptus kinds of Greek manuscripts. I was in a church one time, forget the state, and the deacons had me there. They wouldn't dare have the whole church hear me. I don't know why, but there was a big debate in the church. They had a Christian school. Got to be careful of these Christian schools, some of them, because they get off on wrong tracks and change the whole church. Well, this Christian school was NIV, mad, happy. They wanted to change the whole church to the NIV. They're using the King James Bible. The pastor wanted to continue to use it. And so they said, let's have a discussion of what we should use, the King James or something else. So let's call a professor from Grand Rapids Baptist Seminary. I used to be called Baptist, now they just call it something else, take off Baptist. That's the JIB school. What's it called?
Cornerstone.
Okay, Cornerstone. Just get a professor there to speak on the text, what he believes, and have me come there to speak on the text. And I said, that'd be fine. And I said, I'd like to speak, I don't know, after or before. Anyhow, took two of their professors to come on to speak. And then I came up afterwards and spoke. And I wanted to get a copy of what they said. Wouldn't come. That's interesting. We must have not wondered, they must not have known they were really right. They're not too sure of themselves because they wouldn't come on the tape. I don't want to hear the tape. But anyway, the pastor had us to come in. And in that audience of deacons, there are 5 or 6 deacons, I forget how many. Raised his hand and said, do you have any documentation as to the historicity of the chain of events of how our received text came down through the history? I said, sir, I do not, but I'll go home and look it up. And I looked it up, and I got 37 historical links, and that's what these are, to show the pedigree of our King James Textus Receptus, New Testament, Greek text. Historical evidence of the received text, the apostolic period, 33 to 180, all the apostolic churches use the received kind of text. Church in Palestine used it. Syrian Church in Antioch used it. In the early church period, 100 to 312 AD. The Peshitta Syria was made out of 150 AD. Papyrus 66, received contact. The Italic Church in northern Italy, that text. The Gallic Church in southern France used the received kind of text. I say received kind of text because it wasn't called that in that day, but the same traditional text that we have under our King James Bible. The Celtic or Celtic Church in Great Britain used the received kind of text. The Church of Scotland and Ireland used it. Pre-Waldensian churches used it. The Waldensians today, 120 AD onward, used the received type of text. Historical evidences in the Byzantine period of the church, 312 to 1453 AD. Gothic version of the 4th century used it. Codex W of Matthew used it. Codex A in the Gospels, 5th century used it. The vast majority of the extended New Testament manuscripts all used the received kind of text. In fact, 99% of them, about 5,210 out of 5,255 total manuscripts, used the received kind of text. Again, the Greek Orthodox use the received text. In fact, the present Greek Orthodox Church still uses the received text. Mom sent us over, my mother sent Mrs. Wade and me over there in the 1980s to Israel. And we went over to Israel, we went to Egypt, and so on. I said, Mom, you want to send us? That's fine. I didn't know whether I should go over there or not, but they sent us over there, and that's why I put her interest in it. While we were there, we went to the Church of the Nativity, which is where Jesus was supposed to be born. And we got down into the basement, you know, there's some rocks and different caves and so on. Who knows? They had a huge cathedral, big church. And while we were there, there was a big bearded fellow coming in. He was one of the priests of that Greek Orthodox Church. I said to myself, I'm going to ask him what kind of Greek text he used. So I went up to him. I said, sir, do you use the received traditional text or do you use the Westcott and Hort text? I didn't know even whether he knew what it was. Westcott and Hort, absolutely not. He knew exactly what it was. He used the traditional text and unwritten that came in about right to this day. If you take a modern Greek text of the Greek Orthodox Church, you'll find Matthew, Mark 16, 9-20 is there. 1 John 5, 7, 8 is there. All the different things that Westcott and Hort threw away, the Greeks still have. We don't have to agree with their theology, and we don't. But their text is still traditional text. Haven't changed, haven't moved. Haven't moved. Reminds me of the story of the newlyweds. Drove down the car, and husband was driving. The wife was very close to that husband, just behind him. And then later on, 25, 30 years later, husband driving, wife was 2-3 feet away. And the pastor said, why is this? The husband said, I haven't moved. I haven't moved. Anyhow, I don't be hurting the ladies. The Greek Orthodox Church hasn't moved. They're still using the traditional text. Pardon my humor here, I don't like to get too humorous. The early modern period, 1453 to 1881, all the churches of the Reformation used the received text. Martin Luther and all of them. The Erasmus Speaker's Testament used it, 1516. The Competentia Polyglot, 1522 used it. Martin Luther's German Bible, 1522, used the text. The early modern period, 1453 to 1881, William Tyndale's Bible, 1525, used the received text. The French version of Oliver Tom, 1535, used it. Coverdale Bible, used it. The Matthew's Bible, all these Bibles used it. The early modern people, the Taverns Bible, of 1539, the Great Bible, used the received text, the Stephanus Bible, the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible, all of these, and the early modern, the Spanish version used it, the Beza Greek text used it, the Czech version used it, the Italian version of Diodati, all used it, the King James Bible, 1611 used it, the Elsevier Brothers used it, 1624, the received text, the King James, is the original received kind of text, down through the corridors of time, 37 historical links. Will that, Pastor, take a few questions if you want, and people? Well, we'll stop right here until tomorrow.
All right, well, it takes some time, and a lot of information there, a lot of good information. Does everybody understand what he's talking about? We talked about the two different types of texts. Just nod your head yes or no. Does everybody understand that? Okay? All right. He's trying to show you that from the early church times up until we have the King James Version, that the Greek text underlying the New Testament has been consistent. All right, there were handwritten manuscripts. That's what a manuscript is, handwritten in Greek. Capital letters are called, is it the uncials, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, and then you have the cursive, which is your small letter. They're all consistent. Now, a lot of times, and I'll ask this question, as we hear this, well, the received text won't start until Erastus, and that's false, okay? We're talking about the received text, we're talking about a received kind of a text, but I'll let Dr. Wade answer that question about the received text and how that's oftentimes falsely stated that it started with Erasmus.
All right, did the Greek text of Unwise Opinion about start with Erasmus? No, it started back in the Apostles' day, Paul, Peter, James, and John, and so on. You say, well, and we had these 37 historical links. Sure, they used this received kind of text way in the apostolic ages. Why do our fundamentalist brethren want to nail us down and say Erasmus began the text that underlies the King James Bible? In this book, the newest book I've got, Bob Jones University's Errors on Bible Preservation, the same thing is repeated over and over. Other books are repeated. The Mind of God, the Mind of Man repeats that same thing. God's Word in Our Hands. Again, Bob Jones' sponsored book repeats that saying. Why do they do that? Here's the reason. They claim Erasmus had only 7 manuscripts. And he had more because he consulted with the European libraries, 200 or 300 other references. He may have had 7, 10, 15, whatever it was in his hand, but he, the greatest Greek scholar in the European continent of his day, was Erasmus, the Severus Erasmus. He went to other manuscripts, but they claim only had 7 manuscripts. If he only had 7, they're then saying the text receptus of our New Testament King James Bible is based only on 7 manuscripts. See what they're aiming at? And you know, something based on 7 manuscripts, you say, well, fool you on that, I don't want anything to do with that. You would discard it. That's pure lie. I've said every one of these books I've written for the last 10 years or whatever, I've refuted it. They don't care. It sells books. It sells their point of view. Erasmus, 7 manuscripts. We have just a few manuscripts representing our New Testament. What do they have? It's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. We have 5,210, not 7. But anyway, that's the first thing. They want the second reason why they wanted Erasmus in our the origin of our Greek text, the New Testament, is Erasmus was a Roman Catholic, and therefore our King James Bible was from the text of Roman Catholic. Therefore, we're somehow in cahoots with Rome. Well, it's wrong. We didn't use Erasmus text. We used the text of Beza, 5th edition, 1598. And Erasmus was 1516, Beza 1598. If my math is correct, that's 82 years later. 1516, 1598, 82 years later, is the text that underlies the King James Bible. Dr. Scribner says that's the text, the chief text the King James translators use. 95% to 99%, Jesus, 5th edition. Now, granted, Erasmus had a text that was similar or something, but that's not the text we use. We use the Beza text after 82 years of getting mistakes taken care of and different typographical errors and mistakes and so on. That's the text. So, he's Roman Catholic. But then, even just look at what kind of Roman Catholic was Erasmus. If they want to nail us with Erasmus, which is wrong, it shouldn't, because that's not our text. But even if they do it, what is Erasmus? Erasmus was the kind of Roman Catholic that threw away a cardinal's hat. Would you think that guy was a real Catholic to throw away a hat of a cardinal? That's all he does. He's a horrible Catholic, as far as I'm concerned. Why, if he's a genuine Catholic, he would gladly have been a cardinal, see? Number two, he had the audacity to put to the hands of people not only the Latin, which is the Catholic, that's their language, you know, Catholicism, Latin. He put the Greek text in parallel column with the Latin. He violated that law of the Roman Catholic Church. Number three, he wanted everybody in the world to read the Bible and to know the Bible. That's not what the Catholic Church taught them, has been. Just the priests. Read it and interpret it. You people in the pews, don't you dare read that Bible. That's the historic. Fourthly, Erasmus was buried in a Protestant cemetery. Right there in Switzerland, Basel, Switzerland. I have pictures of his grave. What kind of a Roman Catholic would be buried in the Protestant? He wanted to have a reformation in the Roman Catholic Church. He still stayed in it. Well, so did Martin Luther, I understand, stay in it. He wanted to have a reformation. But that's the type of Catholic he was. He wasn't a real strong. Furthermore, in the fifth place, his books, Erasmus' books, were banned by the Roman Catholic Church. So that's the kind of Roman Catholic he was. So if these fellows want to play footsie with Roman Catholic and Erasmus, he wasn't a real strong man, even though that wasn't the basis of our King David Act. The second reason, or third reason, why they want to nail us with Erasmus is that he was a humanist. See, Roman Catholic, humanist, King James, see, throw it in the trash. What kind of a humanist was he? He was not an atheistic humanist. He was a humanitarian. He believed in humanities and helping people. That's in his day, 1516, that's what a humanist was. So he's not this big atheist humanist. So that's the reason to try to nail us with Erasmus. Yes, sir, Pastor.
Yeah, before 1611, when the King James Bible was completed, what did the English speak? Which Bible was the most popular Bible, or received Bible, up until the Yet to Be translation?
What Bible before the King James was the one that they used? Usually they used the Bishop's Bible, some like the Geneva Bible. Our pilgrims came over the Geneva Bible. But it was either the Bishop's Bible, maybe the Coverdale, or Geneva was one. But all of those Bibles were based on a received text, and otherwise the King James Bible. They weren't as good. My wife... that's all right. I think that's all right. I would just leave it, yeah. What is that one that you had, honey, that you used to listen to?
A Tyndale
Bible. She used a Tyndale Bible. And one, see, we read the Bible 85 verses per day in our home. We put on the tape and we listen to the King James. And this time she was referring to the Tyndale Bible. She wondered, what was it? Was it good? Was it bad? Was it, how did it fare with the King James? Repeatedly, it failed in accuracy with the King James Bible. So it's still the text receptive, but if you add this or take away this tendency. They had a Bible based on the right text, but it wasn't pristine. It wasn't perfect. And that's one of the reasons our King James translators asked, may your majesty be pleased to have a new translation, the present ones extant, not answering to the originals. That's what John Reynolds begged the King James, to have a one that's accurate, and that's what we got. These others were good, but they weren't top-notch. Yes, sir.
Now, when the King James Bible came out in 1611 and was finished, how long was it until, like the Pilgrims, the Protestants, the Puritans in the United States accepted the King James Bible of 1611 to be a better version or the best they could they had?
Mm-hmm. How long was it before the Puritans came over to accept it? I'm not sure the exact age. It probably took maybe 20, 30 years. They came over the Bible there of Geneva because they were Calvinists and they were Puritans and they wanted the theology of John Calvin. And the King James Bible didn't have any notes. They didn't believe it. And so they didn't have it. So it took a while for those Puritans to get it. I don't know exactly whether 20 years, 30 years. It wasn't too long before those in this country switched from that over to the King James, or they call authorized version of the 1611. Yes, Pastor.
I've got a couple of questions. First is, I know the answer, but I want you to address it. That is, was Erasmus aware of either Codex B or Alec? And if he was, what did he do with it? As far as, did he think it was great? Did he like it? Secondly, we have in our hands the edition of the 1769 King James Version, which you write about. Mm-hmm. And if you could talk about the differences, and sometimes people from the other side say, well, see, there was it was totally revised. So, comment on both of those.
All right, the first question had to do with
Erasmus. Was he aware of?
Aware of being out.
Yeah.
Yes, Erasmus was aware of Vatican and Sinaiticus. Yes, he was well aware. In fact, when he went to his European universities and libraries in search of documentation, he found many of the manuscripts. Not many, too many, but some that went along with certain readings that the Vatican was familiar with and was used. He rejected it. He saw all the other manuscripts that he found, without exception, united on this particular person was looking at it, so he discarded those and did not use them. And I think for a very valid reason, they were inferior and they were not proper. So it was over, yes.
That is actually documented, I believe it was documented in the 20s by, I forget the man's name in his book, but Dr. Sorensen has the documentation of that. And he was a New Testament scholar, like from Princeton or Yale. Mm-hmm. He was Erasmus's like a biographer or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he actually quotes the fact that he knew of those and he rejected them.
Exactly. Well, thank you. The second part was what?
Was we have the
1769.
Right.
King James Bible, that's the one that we are using presently. And the question is, there's a lot of changes here between that and the present one that we use. And they like to say, well, who cares about the new King James? That's just another edition of the King James Bible. No, it is not, because 80 to 100,000 changes in the new King James. How about in the original 1611 versus the one we use today? I made a study of that from Genesis Revelation. My tape recorder was King James Bible, and I listened to the tape. In my hands, I had the 1611, original 1611, and I looked at the changes. Whenever I found a change, I put it in red, see? And I kept on going. So now they have thousands of changes in spelling. S-I-N-N-E was sin in 1611. S-I-N to that, they changed spelling. A thousand changes in punctuation, commas, semicolons, colons. But as far as the words that I could hear in my ear, see, I always go with a hearing. If I could hear the difference, I totaled the thing up, about 416 things in my ear that was different. Out of the whole Bible, almost 800,000 words. I came up with 416. And of those, many of them were among and amongst. It's the same word, but I can hear it. Among and amongst. I counted it. If you take away all those words that are just about the same, only I counted it, to be honest, I said, hey, I hear differently. If you take away all those, you get about 115, 135, where they added a butter and ant. And then you take away, since I wrote that analysis, there's an abbreviation. And just the word like and, you know what I mean? Just like an and sign. We say and something. They had a whole bunch of those, probably about 25 of those. So if you subtract 25 or 60 or whatever from 136, you get about less than 100 actual additions, subtraction, change, and are but very, very minor. So these people say there are hundreds of thousands of changes, so it's all right to change like anything, they're dead wrong. If they mean changes of the year, if they mean spellings, maybe right, but this is a very serious error that they make in that year. That's available, that study, minus the BFT number 1294 is the number of it, and it's very small, but it gives all the different ones.
Any more questions?
Yes, sir.
One of the works stuck back in my library someplace from college days is Nations for the Greek. Mm-hmm. And I haven't looked at it in years, but clue me in, where's Machen coming from?
All right, where is Machen? They're from Princeton Center. Machen, his Greek text has got a five-case system. We studied with the Davis's text, the Dean and Maddie and Robertson with an eight-case system. So that's just on the surface. Five forms, but there are three different more to add because of different uses. Genitive and ablative and locative, incidental, and dative instead of just eight. So that's the first thing about Machen. But Machen, I'm just about sure, would follow D.B. Warfield over there in Princeton the same time that he was there, and he would go along with the Westcott and Hort Greek text, as did D.B. Warfield. And D.B. Warfield is exalted in this latest book by the Bob Jones professor, Dr. Samuel Schneider, as he says, we got a great scholar in D.B. Warfield, which is an assistant of Machen, associate of Machen. But I differ with that. See, D.B. Warfield wrote a book on the Bible. So I don't remember the title. I have the book, but I don't remember the title. Tell me about the Bible. But the thing that Machen does not agree with, Warfield does not agree with, is the inerrancy even of the original. See, he doesn't like to use the word inerrancy. He says inerrancy is not a good word. There's lots of questions. Certainly he doesn't believe in the preservation, Bible preservation, of Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek words. of what he believes in the West Coast North Text, which changes a little bit. So basically, that's mentioned. As I say, my curious is a good man, a godly man, so on the Bible. He's a Presbyterian man. And I think he's one of the men that came from Princeton to form another school. I'm not sure. In fact, I think he was Dr. David Otis Fuller's man in his wedding, wasn't he, Bob? Didn't mention Fuller? Something like that. And they were friends, you know. And Dr. Fuller, of course, was from Texas Tech. So that would be mentioned. As far as I know, I'm not in detail on it, but I would say he'd go with Warfield. That's not.
I think Adam Davis and Manager.
Yes, but his wedding.
I don't know about
Major. They were friends, and I know that they...
He's
a teacher, I think, but one of the teachers of Dr. Fuller. Yes, you have another question. Sure.
A lot of times when I'm searching for a career in the vernacular of our children, I'll go to a concordance, you know, in some sense, it's like going to the dictionary and get the definition. Now, we've got various concordances out there, Strong's and numerous others. What concordance would you suggest just on that level?
Mm-hmm. What concordance would I recommend to Holy Text Receptus? Well, the original Strong's was only purely Text Receptus. In fact, the original Strong's had an appendix saying, here are the changes the 1881 English Revised Version had made. Now they've taken away the appendix and just have the other. I appreciate that. And of course, now with computers, you just click on the computer to find anything you want. But we have, I think, Strong's Concordance. I think it's very helpful because it illustrates all of the different uses of the English words. And they've made a few mistakes when they have an addendum or corrigenda or whatever you want to call it. But the definitions are on the back. Some are not as good as they could be, but they give an overall picture. It gives a Hebrew script, a Greek script, and you get a picture of what some of the meanings might be of that word. I know that Mrs. Rippenser doesn't like Strong because he has some definitions that are perhaps different theologically, but I think you have enough as an English-speaking reader to get what you generally should get from that. As far as further on that, I prefer the analytical Greek lexicon and the analytical Hebrew lexicon as lexicons or dictionaries over and above Strong's, because if you have the Greek text, you can see what that word comes from and what it means. For instance, somebody would say the word come, come here. If you didn't speak English, you would not have the faintest idea that come came from the verb to go. Would you? Come and go have nothing to do with it. Same way in Greek. If you have a strange meaning, where did that come from? In the analytical Greek lexicon, the form is given. Over here it says, oh, that's from this verb. Then you go to that verb and you find out what it means. So every single word in the New Testament is analyzed and you can see what it means. So going from the English Strong's is fine. It's a good part. And the analytical Greek or analytical Hebrew is the next step, I believe. Yes, sir.
I have both those Bibles, the Texas and the Heaven.
Uh-huh.
But it's too much for me. I just don't have the capacity to understand it really.
Mm-hmm.
So I admire your knowledge and all. It takes a lot of accumulation, what you said. But the thing that I use is the Bible says, fear God and keep His commandments.
Yes.
That's the whole duty of worship.
Right.
Well, that's just about all I can handle.
Right. Well, that's good. You see, people have asked, what if I don't know the Hebrew and Greek? Fine. No, most of us don't understand it. If you have a King James Bible, you know what the Word of God is in English. And that's what I believe we have in our King James Bible. It's so accurate. From the proper Hebrew, the proper Greek, and accurately translated, so you can have the words of God in English. That's what we need. And that's why I trust that everybody would use that, and that's what they need in Spanish. I think Dr. Gomez is a Spanish Bible, the words of God in Spanish. And the Romanian, it's conforming, the words of God in Romanian. See, I think that's what we have to do in all these languages. The old timers used the right Hebrew and Greek text, and they translated it accurately. But the old timers are dead. And the United Bible Society has come along all over the world, and they've got together the West Cotton Hort text as their basis, and they've changed every language of the world to conform with the false text of the New Testament. That's a travesty on truth. And they've got the money, they've got the people, missionary agencies. I heard just the other day Mission Agency, Wycliffe Bible Translators. Now, they used to use the bad TIV, today's English version, TEV rather, as the basis of all their translations. Now they're using the Message, which is even worse. TIV, TNV. So, we're in serious trouble, and I don't know whether we're ever going to come out of that pit until the Lord comes back, and then he'll straighten things out, I guess, but then we'll not need to have these other guys. Other question, Mike? Yes, sir.
It's another question, but I have a booklet, and it says there's 24 different translations, and they're all either add or they subtract from the King James Version. I was going to bring that with me, but I forgot about that. I'm going to give you this poem, and I don't know really who put this out, but anyway, I give it to some different pastors that use the new IV, you know, and they went to seminary out to Kansas City, and they can't be told anything. I don't tell them anything because I don't know much myself. But I take other important people's sense, and they say not to use anything but the King James Bible.
Yes.
And he points out the errors added or subtracted to. So
that's probably a good little booklet. So right. Get it for them, bring it to them, to see it. Yeah, there are over 100 translations probably in English, and I'll keep going and going, but 24, and of course the current ones are very important. Thank you, sir. Pastor, turn back over to you. I don't want to pour these people to death.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, why don't we close with a word of prayer? And we'll be dismissed. Our Father, we thank you today for this time that we can be here. Lord, we love you and we appreciate Dr. and Mrs. Wade. And ask, Lord, that you just help us to return safely tomorrow. And bless the remainder of the Christ's name. Amen. All right. You are dismissed.